following podcast is produced following the workshop Chinese Objects Outside of China, which took place at the Winterthur Museum, Garden and Library from June 5th to June 9th, 2017. The workshop is part of the Chinese Object Study Workshop Programme, administrated by the Freer Gallery of Art and the Arthur M. Sackler Gallery, the Smithsonian Museum's Asian Art, and sponsored by Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. Introduction music may have sounded like it was from the East, but actually it's a Western creation, quickly produced by my brother based on what he thought Chinese music may sound like. The idea of what is Chinese is central to this podcast, which will explore a large plate at the Winterthur Museum. Today we would refer to the plate as Chinese export porcelain, yet in times gone by it would simply be known as Chinese. This large plate is what is regularly known as a charger. Charger plates were used in European fine dining and would sit underneath a plate or bowl to protect the table from the heat of the food. In addition, their purpose could be decorative, adding colour and vitality to a table. This was of crucial importance to the fashion of fine dining which swept through Europe in the early modern period. Otherwise, the plates were purely decorative, serving no function within dining but adding aesthetic appeal and adding character to the household. The plate is just over 31 centimetres in diameter, about the same size as the foot long from Subway, and sits about 4.5 centimetres in height, the same distance as your stomach expands after eating said Subway. The object is made from porcelain, and this is complemented with a lime alkaline glaze. In short, the production schedule would involve moulding the porcelain before applying an underglaze and then overglaze enamel. Finally, the plate would be gilded, but more information on these stages later. As can be seen, the plate is rich in decoration, containing a frenzy of various colours, and its busyness is distracting. However, a closer look at many features of the plate can help reveal some interesting information and provide clues to unpack the object's provenance. This short podcast intends to provide an introduction to the plate. In doing so, I will illuminate how objects have their own biographies and show that their stories can help enhance our understanding of history. By analysing the plate's stylistic features, in addition to its biography, I intend to shed light on areas such as transnational commerce, the European imagined image of China, early modern European national relations, European masculinity, Chinese porcelain production, as well as follow the changing fashions of Chinese objects in the West. Finally, I will remark on the role the plate now plays within the Winterthur Museum. Some of the astute listeners will have realised I'm British, and therefore I must apologise in advance for my Anglo-Atlantic approach. I promise it's all relevant. We will start with the plate's appearance, and firstly pay attention to the shield in the centre of the plate. Here we see a coat of arms. This coat of arms provides a key clue for dating the plate. Divided into four quarters, the coat of arms has four emblems which point toward the plate's relationship with Britain. In the top left, sitting proudly, are three lions. The lions are gold, set against a red background, a regal combination of colours. This combination of colours and lions had first been used by Richard the Lionheart in the 12th century and has been used on every succeeding monarch. The lions represent Richard's genealogy, symbolising his lineage and also the marriage of European monarchs. Thus, each lion represents Henry I, Godfrey I and William X. The lions represent authority and dignity, perhaps ironic when considered that the English national football team continues to use this symbol despite its continuous embarrassing performances. Below the lions is the harp, the famous motif of Ireland. Some of you will recognise this motif from Ireland's famous export, Guinness. The harp is in gold, set against a blue background, as had been used since Henry VIII established the Kingdom of Ireland in 1541. It is understood that the harp was central to Celtic culture, and monarchs would have had a resident harper, a sign of their privilege. To the right of the harp is three rows of fleur-de-lis, with nine in total. As the name suggests, the fleur-de-lis originated from France, and translates as flower of the lily. The lily became a symbol of French monarchy, said to signify perfection, light and life. British monarchs adopted the motif due to the fact they quartered French arms up until 1801. Finally, above the fleur-de-lis and to the right of the lions is a recognisable thistle of Scotland. The thistle has been the emblem of Scotland since the reign of Alexander III, who reigned in the 13th century. According to legend, an invading Norse army was attempting to sneak up at night on the Scottish army's encampment. During this operation, one barefoot Norseman had the misfortune to step on a thistle, causing him to cry out in pain, thus alerting the Scots to the presence of the North invaders. Today, the thistle remains a symbol of Scotland, understood as demonstrating both Scotland's beauty and fierceness. What is of particular interest to our understanding of the plate is that the combination of these motifs suggests the time frame from which the plate could have been produced. In 1707, the Act of Union was signed, and thus the Kingdom of England and the Kingdom of Scotland, which had previously been separate states, were merged under the Kingdom of Great Britain. Therefore, the plate, as it contains both English and Scottish insignia, was most likely created following the 1707 Act. A crown sits atop of the shield, reaffirming, perhaps unnecessarily, I think we're getting the picture, the link between the monarch and Great Britain. Below the coat of arms is the banner, which reads Ingeland. This is not a typo, not Old English, but rather it is Dutch, and here lies our second clue. In the 17th century, the Dutch Republic, France and England all feared the growing power of Spain. Consequently, in 1717, the three nations signed the Triple Alliance. The Dutch spelling of England is therefore likely to symbolise the pact between the nations. Furthermore, as Claire Le Corbelier outlined in her book, China Trade Porcelain, Patterns of Exchange, similar plates exist in European collections, which contain the names of chief towns and provinces of the United Netherlands, France and England, leading Claire to the conclusion that they were probably produced during the period of cordiality. Amidst Britain's tethered ties with Europe today, the plate serves as a reminder of a more peaceful relationship with European neighbours. The fact that England is spelt in Dutch also raises questions as to who commissioned the plate. This is answered by the fact that during the 17th and 18th century, the Dutch East India Company, known as the VOC, dominated the commercial relationship with China. The VOC was importing tens of thousands of porcelain a year from China. It is understood that between 1730 and 1789, the VOC imported 42.5 million pieces of porcelain from China. At this time, European production lagged behind China in terms of quality, and the exotic appeal added prestige to the tables of European wealthy. What better way to impress your guests than to serve the food on plates from the Far East? Commissioned by the VOC, armorial plates from China were particularly popular in Europe throughout the 18th century. The depiction of the family arms could enhance the family's social standing, demonstrating a mastery of the commercial ties of China. In addition, while European interactions with Chinese porcelain in the early modern period have tended to be associated with women, armorial porcelain provides an interesting insight into the masculine relationship with porcelain. As Jacqueline van Ghent argued, the trade network navigated in exporting armorial porcelain was a male-dominated sphere. The men who braved the seas during the VOC voyages would have used these plates as a display of social pride and elite masculinity. According to historians, in the 18th century, Britain ordered between 4,000 and 5,000 armorial wares, while the Netherlands ordering only 500 plates with family arms. The Dutch were not the first to commission armorial wares, nor were they the last. The Portuguese, prior to the Dutch, had a hunger for armorial wares, and after the Dutch, in the late 18th century, the United States of America joined the party. This pattern aptly demonstrates the rise of nations within the porcelain commercial network. It is also important to remember that China remains central to this network. Even with the rise of porcelain production in the West, Chinese products still found a ready market. So now we have clearly established how the plate was made for European audience, now you must assess Chinese dynamic to the plate. The quality of the porcelain, in addition to the fact that China dominated porcelain production at this time, leads us to conclude that the plate was produced in Jingdezhen, a city world famous for its porcelain production. However, the treaty port of Canton was also influential within the plate's construction. Here at Canton, now known as Guangzhou, European traders ordered personalised pieces of porcelain to be produced in Jingdezhen. European traders were restricted to Canton and relied on Chinese agents in the city to fulfil their orders. Here, European traders would choose from stock designs, and hence many of the plates produced are very similar. Closer inspection of our plate shows that the crown of arms was added after the designs. As aforementioned, other plates existed in European collections with the same design on the rim, suggesting that the coat was added afterwards. European merchants would request their personalisation and hope that the message was successfully transmitted and translated to the artists. The plate presents an interesting dichotomy. In the centre is a bold statement of British royalty, and surrounding it is a whimsical and colourful depiction of the feminine China. 12 panels surround the plate, perhaps symbolising either hours of the day or perhaps months of the year. The flowers within the 12 panels hint towards specific seasons. If we consider the figure chasing a fly, situated above the crown as panel 1, then the pine tree in panel 8 could symbolise spring, the beginning of a new year in China. In panel 4, these flowers could be chrysanthemums, which represent autumn. It could be that the depictions of China, the mandarins and long gowns, the flowers and vibrant use of colours are random, stereotypical depictions of the East added to the plate to create an image of exotic luxury. Called chinoiserie, this imagined image of a romantic East was popular in the West, particularly as industrialisation took hold. In this sense, a timeless China depicted on porcelain could provide an escape from the mechanised life in the West. This was evident in the late 19th century when Oscar Wilde decorated his room at Oxford University with blue and white porcelain, claiming, "I find it harder and harder every day to live up to my blue China." Furthermore, the Oriental imagery further underlines the Eastern provenance of the plate, perhaps a way of reminding visitors of the prestige of the plate's owners. Looking closely at the panels suggests some thought lay behind the imagery. At 11 o'clock, the man solemnly looking into the water could be Li Bo, the famous Tang Dynasty poet, who, as legend has it, drowned when he drunkenly tried to catch the moon in the water's reflection. Furthermore, at 7 o'clock, this could be Li Tieguai, a mythical figure and one of the eight immortals in the Taoist pantheon. Li Tieguai is recognisable from his depiction alongside a gourd bottle from which vapour emanates, and on the panel it's clear that smoke is rising from the bottle behind the figure. According to our reliable source, Wikipedia, the 8 immortals are considered to be signs of prosperity and longevity, so they are popular themes within ancient and medieval art. The lotus flower, often depicted in Chinese art, symbolises elegance, beauty, perfection, purity and grace, and this motif also finds its way onto the plate, as does a pot with the lingzhi fungus within it, which is known to symbolise great health and longevity. It is interesting to consider whether the European audience understood the significance of these symbols, or just appreciated their tenuous connection with China. It is more likely that the European traders chose the designs at random, just wanting to add oriental connotations to the plate. Furthermore, it seems the Chinese painters would be more than happy to reproduce stock images on the plate. With regards to the coats of arms, they held particular significance to the European audience, but for the artists, perhaps they had no meaning. It's more than likely that they didn't understand the significance of the harp connoting Ireland. Therefore, not only is this an imagined China, but also an imagined Britain, as although the Act of Union merged the states, this is not to say that this was a cordial union. It was through coercion and aggression, elements which starkly contradict the symbolisms of the fleur-de-lis. The plate would have been ordered by the VOC merchants in Canton. The requirements passed on to the artisans in Jindajian, which is a journey of just under 1,000 kilometres. Then the craftsmen would mould the hard paste and add the underglazed blue, the overglazed animals, and then the coats of arms would be added. The product would be transported to Canton, where it would be handed over to the VOC merchant and then shipped back to Europe. As the century progressed, enamelling could be performed in Canton. However, it is likely that this dish was obtained its design in Jindajian. Thus, from start to finish, this piece of porcelain was part of an early form of globalisation. At the Victoria and Albert Museum, London, a similar plate exists. The plate in London is slightly larger, with a diameter of 38 centimetres, the same height as a bowling pin. The panels are almost identical, but in different order. Comparing the plates suggests that the designs were popular. In other words, the European market were hungry for chinoiserie plates with European coats of arms. Furthermore, the fact that King George V gave the plate to the V&A suggests a prestigious audience which readily collected armorial wares. So how did this plate get to the Winterfell Museum? A common problem which historians and art historians face is tracking the life of objects, as unfortunately clues to the life of the art are hard to come by, and we only have limited information on how the plate's life between the early 18th century and today, 300 years later, came about. Sometimes objects can speak for themselves, and the condition of the plate is in question today suggests some of the clues on how it was used. Along the rim of the plate, there is damage and signs of some restoration. It would have been very common for this type of plate to have been displayed in a metal mount on a wall, meaning the plate had an aesthetic use rather than a practical dining one. On the underneath of the plate, a sticker informs us that the plate once belonged to Matahede collection. This is a reference to the collectors Raffi and Milfred Matahede. Raffi Y. Matahede was born in 1901 in the central Persian town of Kashan, and in his 20s, due to the upheaval in Persia, left to start a new life in New York. Cleverly, Raffi realised his knowledge of Arabic was important in New York, and he soon had a job at the Metropolitan Museum of Art under the curator of Islamic art, Maurice Dumont. Here he forged contacts that would help him establish his own business in art dealing between East and West. He began importing Persian wares into America before realising that Chinese export porcelain had a ready market, and following the Second World War, due to the economic turmoil in Europe, the large collections of export porcelain in European hands found their way to the United States. While the couple ran a business selling wares, they collected Chinese export porcelain. Apparently this was driven by their interest in animal figures, religious subjects, and subjects that went back and forth between East Asia and Europe. This explains why our plate would have significance to the collectors. Raffi himself symbolised the intersection between East and West, just like the plate. We know that the plate came to the Winterthur Museum via Leo and Doris Hodroff, who purchased objects from the Matahede collection. Leo Hodroff, who sadly passed away in 2009, is remembered as a foremost collector of Chinese export art. The plate came to the Winterthur Museum in 2003, a gift from Leo and Doris. It is understandable why the Winterthur Museum provides a perfect home for this plate. In the field of decorative arts, it is a fantastic resource. And so our story finally finishes. From Holland, Canton to Jindajian, informally via Persia, England, and finally in Wilmington, Delaware, this plate is just one example of the rich stories objects can tell. The Winterthur Museum is a treasure trove, bursting with more stories to be told.